Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show.
It may well possess a rudimentary intelligence.
I'm trying to think, but nothing happens.
Felt a great disturbance in the force.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
Come on, bark like a dog for me.
Where's the goodies?
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
I bet you wouldn't have done anything like this if Mom and Dad were here.
You filthy criminal.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Here are your hosts, Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Again, the 2-2 to Larry's. In the air to left field. Back at the track, at the wall. We are tied. 6-6 here in the eighth. They are dancing in the streets of New York right now.
And in East Northport, we're recording on Everything Old is New Again. Welcome to our extraordinary feast of fun that we're going to be having with David Cohen, the extraordinary Yankees fan that you are.
Yes, I'm very excited today, Douglas. We have a very special guest with us. And just hearing that clip again just brought back so many memories. And I got chills down my spine again, like what happened when Jim Leyritz hit that home run.
In the World Series 96, Game 4 against the Mark Wohlers, the Atlanta Braves, and turned the series around a bit there. As we witnessed just recently the historic victory of the Houston Astros in the World Series, and we can see that there's a rise in the baseball ratings over the last few years. We're reminded once again of the popularity of America's favorite pastime, at least mine, baseball. This week we have the privilege of hosting a World Series hero of days gone by to explore all things baseball. David, do you care to introduce our guest with the official intro?
Sure. The official intro is that hopefully Jim's still on the air, by the way. Throughout his career with the New York Yankees, Jim Leyritz has been credited for significantly changing the momentum of several series by hitting numerous clutch postseason home runs. In addition to his Yankee days, Jim also played an integral role for the 98 San Diego Padres, leading them to the World Series by hitting, what was it, 4 home runs and driving in 10 RBIs as the Padres went on to play and lose to the New York Yankees in the 98 World Series. Jim works for several, I just want to note this, several charitable foundations, including the board of the 9/11 Education Trust Foundation and the ALS Association for Lou Gehrig's Disease, PinkTie.org and PinkTie 1000. Welcome to the show, Jim Leyritz.
Thanks, guys, for having me, Doug and Dave. I appreciate it.
And now, after all that, we have about 3 minutes left. No, I'm kidding.
Doug writes all this stuff. I just read it.
Well, Everything Old is New Again. We do have a little bit of history we're going to throw in there, so we want to make sure we're on the same page.
Exactly.
And there's a book that you wrote that I want to say is a great peel of the onion and look behind the scenes, called Catching Heat. And in there, you define as or indicate that your defining moment was that home run in the World Series in Game 4 that we talk about or just heard. After reaching that lifetime goal of being a World Series star playing for the Yankees, what you do in life once you've received or achieved that huge goal? But first, before we do that, let's take a look at where you came from and how this happened. I know that you were a friend of Tom Brenneman growing up, a son of Hall of Fame broadcaster Marty Brenneman. And one day you came to meet Pete Rose and Johnny Bench in their prime. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happened and how that influenced you to become a catcher?
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that I look back on when I was writing the book, just realizing the sacrifices that my parents made, my brothers, my sisters made to really help me pursue a dream of playing professional baseball. And that means, Tommy Brenneman was one of my good friends. Every spring training from basically 1973 to 1977, we went to Tampa, made the 17-hour drive with my mom and dad, my brother and sister, and we were able to go to spring training and stay at the team hotel in Tampa and then just really get to know the guys and get in and hang around with them. And, you know, I was a ball boy for George Foster and Ken Griffey playing tennis. Tommy and I got to hang around, the locker rooms a little bit. But there was one time that really changed a lot in my life. And it was Eric Parseghian's World of Sports had come down to film a show. And they were going to do hitting with Pete Rose and catching with Johnny Bench. And at that time, Pete was like my idol. I mean, I wore number 14. I ran to first base after a walk. I really idolized everything that he did. And unfortunately, he picked Tommy to do the hitting, and I got pissed with Johnny Bench to do the catching. And at the time, I was a shortstop center fielder. I was like the athlete, so I didn't really do any catching. Well, we did the catching segment with Johnny Bench, and we, you know, I did the drills. I threw down to second base. We did, you know, I was the kid that was showing what he was teaching. And after we got done, he called me over and he said, "Hey, kid," he said, "you know, you do the drills pretty good." He goes, "You a catcher?" I said, "No, Mr. Bench, I'm a shortstop center fielder. I wanted to kind of pattern myself after Pete." And he said, "Well, you know, son, catching is the quickest way to the big leagues." Yeah, you know, I was like, yeah. I think I was 13 or 14 years old. I'm like, "Well, Mr. Bench, that's great." You know, and I think he could tell I wasn't buying into it. And he took off his gloves, his catcher's mitt, and he signed it to me. He said, "Maybe this will help you."
Oh, wow. That's cool.
From that day on, guys, I went home that night. I told my father, "I am going to be a catcher." And from that day on, I became a catcher.
Do you still have the mitt?
You know, that's the funny thing. That's the first thing everybody asked me. I'm like, you know what? Back then, I wanted to use it every single game. So I used it until it basically fell apart.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. But the really cool thing was in 2006, I played in a Hall of Fame game. And up until this point, I'd really never seen Johnny too much. I saw Pete a lot because we did a lot of things together. And you know, the Padres did a special thing on me in 98 where Pete, you know, they went to Pete and talked to him about what he knew about me and so forth and so on. But so Johnny and I run into each other at this 2006 Hall of Fame thing. Yeah, I went up to him and I said, "Hey, Johnny, you know, how you doing?" He said, "Hey, Jimmy, you know, hey, good to see you." I said, "Yeah, that's someone. Just thank you for everything." He's like, "What do you mean, thank me?" Because I said, "Well, you know, I grew up in Cincinnati. I grew up a Reds fan." He's like, "Yeah." He goes, "You know, you're friends with Bredeman, right?" And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh," he goes, "Great." I go, "Well, yeah, but you influenced me to become a catcher." And he goes, "Well, that, you know," and he had no idea that I was going to go to the TV show. And he said, "Well, you know, I think he just thought me watching him is why I wanted to become a catcher."
Yeah.
And I said, "No," I said, "You know what? You know, we did a TV show called The Era Parseghian World of Sports together when I was 13, 14 years old. And you gave me your catcher's mitt. And from that day on, I became a catcher. And because of you, I changed my entire life." And he was like, "Wow." And then he goes, I remember the TV show, but I didn't know you were that kid." And it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a great, that must have blown his mind a little bit too. But you still had, let's put it this way, he became a second idol. Certainly go back to Pete Rose. We had a show about if we had to go back in time to take a look at different teams and different players that we would have wanted to have seen if we hadn't seen them. I did see Pete Rose growing up and admired him tremendously. And I should say, he was a player I loved to hate, of course, because he would kill the Mets all the time. I was a fan of those teams back then. But we spoke about him on the show. I'm going to play a small clip and see if he could react to my initial discussion of Pete Rose back then.
He would be a hard hit to be a scotch. Yeah. But he really is. But,
is that an Italian?
But he's a fascinating guy because you can't, I don't, maybe I'm wrong. Am I wrong? Can you not help but admire that guy's enthusiasm for what he did for a living?
Oh, absolutely.
So there we go. That was a little ways back. And just off the cuff, and I'm glad we had you have you on the show to talk about a little bit. I didn't mean to be derogatory with him, but he seems to be a little bit prickly or difficult to talk with sometimes or back in the past. But he is so so knowledgeable about this game. He has more hits than anyone ever in this game. He is, well, we don't have to talk too much. Everyone knows Pete Rose is a tremendous ball player. What made you become have him be your idol?
Well, the first thing I'll say is my dad was very smart when I told him that Pete Rose was my idol, because we were staying at the team hotel. My dad knew a little bit more than I did back then, and he said, "Idolize him for what he does on the field." Because my dad knew about the gambling, my dad knew about the women, the whole thing. He knew all that stuff. And he said, "Idolize what he does on the field." And that's really what I did. What was more amazing to me, though, was being there. You know, we used to go there for almost 2.5 weeks. And just watching his daily work ethic that he would do, because we'd have that opportunity to get behind the scenes a little bit and see what they really did, not just on the field. And the drills that he would do in the batting cages and the things that I would watch him do, his work ethic was amazing. And the thing about it was, guys, he was not a very good athlete. He wasn't Ken Griffey Jr. or Sr. He wasn't George Foster. He wasn't Cesar Geronimo. He wasn't the most gifted athlete in the world. But his work ethic and the way, the passion that he played the game is what really stuck to me and made me realize, you know what? I played with Barry Larkin. Barry Larkin and I came up together, you know, they played summer ball together. I couldn't compete with Barry Larkin, but you know what? I could outwork him. I could out-hustle him, and I could outdo other things. And those are the things that he taught me as a young kid, that, you know what, that's how you're going to make it when you don't have – and you're not blessed with all the talent in the world.
And that definitely paid off for you personally as well.
Yeah, and I think the other thing when you mentioned about him, you know, what, and this is always a discussion with Pete, you know, it's a shame that he did bet on baseball. Because it is a rule, and he's one of my favorite people, you know, as far as, but I also know, too, that this guy has a problem, and his gambling is still an addiction, and I think Rob Manfred was right. You know what? He kind of left the door open and said, he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but he can't be working in baseball, because there's just too many things that could happen. And I think that was the best thing Manfred could have ever said. And I think eventually Pete gets in, because as a player, there was nobody better. There was nobody that had more passion for the game. And it's a shame that he bet on baseball, because like you said, his knowledge and his passion for the game is second to none. And there's a lot of kids missing out because
absolutely.
He doesn't have the opportunity to work with them.
We'll pick that up in a couple of minutes right after this and talk about tenacity over talent with Jim Leyritz right after this.
You're listening to Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Fly ball, right field, maybe, it could be, back at the wall, goodbye, home run, the Yankees win! Jim Leyritz, a two-run homer in the 15th inning, Yankees win 7-5.
Welcome back to Everything Old is New Again. That's a great call on the 95 home run in the ALCS that Jim Leyritz was able to produce for the Yankees and a team that almost made it but was right on the cusp of course, their run in 96. But that was a great run as well. We're here on Everything Old is New Again with David Cohen, of course, and Jim Leyritz, who has written a book, Catching Heat. It's out on Amazon. You can catch wherever you want. Besides that, you can get it on the Kindle. It's a great read, an easy read, but it really opens the door to the behind the scenes of Jim Leyritz's exploration of baseball for his 11 years, and certainly how he grew up and what happened after. So it covers quite a bit. If you're looking for speaking engagements for somebody that's really going to engage an audience and teach a lesson, jimleyritz.com. Feel free to look at that, and we'll get into some charity discussion of what Jim does in the next section after this. But I just wanted to finish up just this discussion. I mentioned this phrase, tenacity over talent, which you mentioned in the book. And about, you talk about Pete Rose and how the young kids are missing out. I really, truly believe that, too. His enthusiasm for this game could really have lent, and it did lend to me when I was in high school. We're about the same age. And every coach that I ever had mentioned Pete Rose running down the first base, hustling, Charlie Hustle and so forth, to the point of almost nausea. You would hear it so much. But it was such a tremendous lesson to see this fella as opposed to some of these guys today. He hit a home run. He hit it singly. Whatever it was, you never knew it. He played it as if he expected to do that and hustled like crazy to overcome maybe some physical, he wasn't as physically gifted as others, let's say. Am I wrong or right?
Well, yeah, the one thing that he really said to me that stuck with me my entire career was the reason he played like that, because he never knew when his last game was going to be. And he always said, if I take my first at-bat in spring training, as serious as I take the last at-bat in a World Series, the pressure is never going to change. And it really stuck with me. And then people always ask me, why were you so able to come through in the clutch and in those big moments, be able to slow things down? And those moments never overtook you, whether it was in the courtroom, whether it was, you know, on the baseball field, wherever it was. How were you able to be able to do that? And really, it went back to that little bit of advice that he said, because you never take one moment for granted, because you don't know if there's going to be a next. And if you do it that way, you embrace every moment that you get. And I think that was such powerful advice. And I don't think Pete knew subconsciously he did know, but consciously I don't think he knew he was giving that great advice. But it was something that always stuck with me.
What also stuck with me was not only Pete Rose, but Tom Seaver comes to mind too. Two fellas that absolutely loved what they were doing for a living, and that enthusiasm came over the airwaves when they did interviews after or before shows, and further, of course, on the field, you could see their professionalism, but the smile on their face, especially Pete Rose, he would get a hit, and he'd be not afraid to smile and enjoy what he was doing. I think that's another lesson, is to dive into something that you love to do, and you'll have that enthusiasm and maybe even be able to follow these lessons, no?
Exactly. Like you said, you know, the passion over the talent, sometimes you can still be successful.
And I would love to have that professor go to my kids, too, and see the kids today, see somebody like Pete Rose, promote the game that way.
Yeah, one of the things I will say, his son still is involved in baseball. He coaches in the independent league. He does help out a lot with them. He goes and visits. And I talked to some of the kids that played for that team, and they're like, oh, my God, I could sit all day and just listen to this guy talk about hitting. Because he was just, so knowledgeable.
And think about us. We just spent 10 minutes talking about him, not even with him, and we could go on forever. So, let's go to some more topics. Of course, that home run we just heard opening this particular segment was the 95 home run. You call that your biggest thrill in baseball beyond anything else. Can you explain why?
The 95?
Yeah.
Well, because I caught all 15 innings, and it was a home run that, of all those first 5 years of saying, listen, I want to play every day. I deserve it, and I fought with management, year in and year out to be up in those moments. And just before that moment, Buck Showalter grabbed me at the bottom of the steps before I went on the on-deck circle and said, Jimmy, you're done after this. Mike Stanley's going to come in to catch because you've caught all 15 innings. He said, make this a bat count. And sure enough, I hit the home run. Do all the celebrating, and I came back and saw him, and I said, "Hey, coach, did I make you count?" and it was a great moment, and for me, that home run, walk off in Yankee Stadium, for me personally, that was my greatest moment. Now, as far as the organization goes, we all know that the '96 is really probably the most important home run for the organization, only because and I always tell this to people, when you look at that '96 home run. If we lose in 1996 like we did, and they lose like they did in 1997, and Mariano gives up that home run to Alomar and they lose, I can guarantee you that Joe Torre fired number one.
Right.
Yeah, number two, George had been wanting to get rid of Rivera since 96 and didn't think, and wasn't happy, wanted to get rid of Pettit, even though Pettit went 21-7, was second in the Cy Young, still was talking about trading him in 97. Some of all that stuff probably would have happened had we not won in 1996 and given kind of a pass for 97 so they could start 98 like they did. And, of course, that turned out to be one of the greatest years ever, and I had to be on the unfortunate losing end of that one.
Yeah, well, that's true. But you're right. There's no way three postseason losses in a row, if that would have happened, 95 through 97, Steinbrenner would have cleaned house. There wouldn't have been and no one was safe at that would have been safe at that point.
Well, that's what I tell Yankee fans when I'm at Yankee Stadium during the Andy Pettit days and the Mariano Rivera retirement jerseys and all these things. I go, listen, do you realize none of this would have happened had the 1996 team not won the World Series?
And it was amazing. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm just saying, when you look back on that and you realize that, it's like, wow, you know what? We were very fortunate to turn that World Series around and be able to win.
You're absolutely right.
And everything for a reason. I mean, look at the high there, and then unfortunately, at some point, there's a dark times coming to all of our lives. In 2007, there was a car accident you were involved with. You went through 3 years of litigation, finally exonerated from these charges. You were facing 15 years in jail. I don't know how you even live for 3 years and sleep at night with that hanging over your head. You were finally exonerated, but the system was difficult. All of that, those trials and tribulations, are in your book. Catching Heat, but just in a few minutes here, this has to be a lesson learned. And if you want to talk about that, because I don't know, here's the thing. Everyone knows that the incident occurred and there's the video on YouTube and blah, blah, but then no one hears 3 years later the exoneration, for the most part, of these charges and showing that, the result of these events. So the press sort of seems to ignore that. So if you want to expand on that, feel free.
Kind of how the book came about, because the book was already written. I already wrote a book called The King and Dad in 2007 before the accident. And the book was titled The King and Dad because it was all about in 2003 when my ex-wife, I just got divorced, I had taken custody of the kids. My ex-wife was back on, having drug issues and other problems. And the San Diego Padres came to me and said, listen, we have a contract for you, $500,000 if you make the team. If you're out of spring training with incentives to make close to $1 million, we want to give you an opportunity to come back from your injuries. And I said, you know what? Yeah, I was going to do that because I was pretty much broke from, fighting for custody. Well, when I went into the courts to tell the courts that I wanted to take the kids with me to San Diego, the judge, the family court judge, said, absolutely not. Hmm. Well, I'm not going to let these kids be raised by a nanny. And I said, well, you'd rather have him raised by someone that has drug issues and some major other issues? You're like, yes, that's their mother. And I was faced with the decision. Long story short, because I know we only have a couple minutes, my father and I talked, and my dad said, you know, I can't tell you what to do, but pray on it. And I went to bed that night. My son woke up in his crib about 2 in the morning and crying and screaming. And I said, you know what? There's no way that I can leave this kid and his two brothers behind and know that they're going to be safe. And so I made a decision that day to quit baseball and never return again. And that was kind of the book that was called The King and Dad, because leaving the nickname, the bright lights of the big city, the King, to coming home to be the best teammate of all, and that was Dad. And unfortunately, I had the accident, so that book was never able to go to press. Hmm. And then during the 3 years of waiting is when we came up with Catching Heat. We'll talk a little bit more about that in the next segment.
Absolutely. We'll be back right after this on Everything Old is New Again with Jim Leyritz.
Let's go, Padres! Let's show them how it's done.
Is that as good as the Yankees one?
Let's go, Padres!
Now, back to America's entertainment pop culture talk show, Everything Old is New Again, with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Nothing fazes him. Long drive left field. Has Leyritz done it again? You bet! You know, you could send this guy to a resort during the spring and summer as long as he comes back in October.
There you go, calling Jim Leyritz in a way Mr. October 2, let's say. This is Everything Old is New Again with David Cohen, Douglas Viviani. We're hosting Jim Leyritz, having a great time. If you want to read a book that's going to capture your imagination and take you behind the scenes, not only of baseball, but of life and lessons that can be learned from the dark times in life as well. Catching Heat, if you want to get involved with Jim with respect to any kind of a speaking engagement, jimleyritz.com. Catching Heat, you can catch, of course, anywhere on Amazon.com. Jim, we would just cut off a little bit the last section.
Yeah, so, you know, basically The King and Dad was the name of the book originally. So when the accident happened, no one wanted to touch it. Then waiting 3 years for trial during that time, I was speaking to some young kids, and a woman came approached me and said, you know, you have a really inspiring story. You know, have you ever thought about writing a book? She had no idea that I already had the 110 pages written. So I said, well, you know, take a look at this. And I sent it to her, and she read it, and she called me up, and she said, no matter what, after you get through this, all this, no matter what happens, we want you to write a book because we think it's inspirational. Everything that you've been through, the setbacks and the faith and perseverance that you show in this story, we want to do it. Yeah, so... It basically, in 2007, before the book, the reason the book didn't come out was because I had the accident. And unfortunately, you know, it was a drinking and driving accident. Both drivers were drinking and driving, myself and the other driver. And I had it was a situation where there was a question of who went through the light. You know, I knew that I didn't, but there was witnesses, supposedly the state had, that they were going to do this. Long story short, you know, we had to go to trial, and the state attorney that was prosecuting me, a woman named Stephanie Newman, was, we didn't know why she was so enamored to take this case to court, because the evidence and the depositions and everything that had been done showed that the accident wasn't my fault. But yet we didn't know why she wanted to pursue this, and she was doing other things to me that, you know, that were just outrageous. But what we found out was that she was running to become a judge, and she wouldn't let it go. And over that 3 years, did it, you know, some more things to be able to get publicity, to do things to me that, you know, she would garner the publicity for. And, you know, it's a tough situation. It was hard on my family. It was hard on the family that lost their daughter, their mother. And it was something that was just such a shame that it had to go 3 years, because it was something that was so obvious that the jury in 30 minutes realized that I didn't cause the accident, and that even the drinking and driving was a question. But I admitted to having a drink and a shot before I got on the road, and they felt like they could not let that go. And so they gave me a first-time DUI, you know, offense, and I was able to get through that. But it was difficult. Like you said, it was, you know, I had three little boys that I was raising, and, you know, they didn't know for those 3 years whether daddy was going to come home or not.
Right. And I'll tell you, I just have to interrupt you a moment, because I'm wondering, you know, we all have difficult times in life, but you didn't know it was going to be 3 years, but as you're living your life for those 3 years with that black cloud hanging over your head and a possible sentence of prison and so forth, how do you, I mean, you know, we've seen trials that have gone awry and the truth didn't come out, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, there was always that chance when you go to trial. How did you do it? It seems like the need for hope and faith faith that something good will happen in life is a message in your book, and is that some way that you got it through this this problem?
Well, exactly. And what happened was basically, you know, I as soon as the accident happened, 6 days later, went to the pastor of my church and just said, "Listen, I don't know why am I being accused of this? Well, you know, why is God putting me through this situation?" And you know, the first thing he told me is, "Don't ask the question why. Just say what is the purpose for this?" And he said, "You will never understand what you're going through while you're in a storm. But when you're out of the storm, you'll realize it." And then he gave me a book called The Purpose-Driven Life to read. And it was written by a pastor named Rick Warren, and who is now my pastor out here in California. And it was just something that really, after about 6 or 7 chapters, woke me up and made me realize the passion that I had for the game of baseball, the way I fought to try to become an everyday player, I was facing a similar type of battle in the courtroom that I had to fight for my freedom and to be able to watch my 3 kids grow up. And I kind of took what I learned over the years on the baseball field and applied it to the courtroom. And it was something that was, you know, I immersed myself into my case. I read every deposition. I became my lawyer's assistant, basically. But it was something that, you know, it was the purpose-driven life really, really changed my life, and it made me understand, you know, not to take anything for granted. And I think that was, you know, that's what really helped me. And during that time, you know, there was a lot of things that were happening in my life that, again, going through the storm, I didn't recognize. But now that I've been through it and got through it, I look back on it and I go, wow, you know, there was definitely a higher power watching over me and guiding me through everything that I went through.
Jim, when you heard during the time that the jury was deliberating, at what point did you hear that they had wrapped it up? And was there a point where you started thinking, oh, this could be a good sign?
Well, I mean, what's the evidence? Some of the evidence got let back in the courtroom. I knew that was a good sign. And like you said, you know that when you leave the courtroom, you felt like, okay, everything went kind of our way, but we have 6 people that are determining our fate. And we, you know, as a catcher and as a somebody that was always in control, it was the hardest thing to do. We went home Friday from the courtroom, and after they deliberated, they couldn't come up with an answer, and the judge forced them to come back on Saturday. We went home Friday night, and we could not figure out what could they be stuck on. Was it the DUI? Was it the DUI where I was going to face 4 years in jail? Which one? I mean, it was such a... We didn't sleep much that night. I do remember waking up the next morning, and my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, Michelle, was sitting in front of the computer, and she said to my mom and I to come over and watch this. And it was Pastor Rick Warren that was... He was giving us a sermon on what the difference between hope and faith is. We watched it together. We held hands. We said a prayer together as we left for the courtroom on Saturday. And we went to the courtroom on Saturday, and sure enough, the jury came out. They said, we want to see some more paperwork and some other things. They went back to deliberate. We went next door, and about an hour later, I got a phone call that said, you know, from the court foreman, come back to the court. The decision's been reached. And I was with probably 12 of my, you know, my mom and dad and my mom and my wife or girlfriend at the time. But we were all together. I said, okay, it's time to go. And I'm telling you, I felt like the Green Mile walk when I walked to that courtroom. Yeah. You know, it was one of those things that I felt like, hey, you know, we should be okay, but at the same time, who knows? And sure enough, we got back to the courtroom, and the thing that scared me the most was when they first read the verdict. You know, I was used to seeing TV shows where they read the higher verdict, you know, the most biggest offense first, second offense, third offense. I had 2 offenses. I was always used to them reading not guilty of the first offense, but guilty of the second. Well, when the court foreman said guilty right away, my heart just sunk. They slapped handcuffs on me in the chair, and I'm like, oh, my God. And I looked at my mom, and we caught eyes, and it was not even more than 10 seconds probably when he read of the lesser charge, DUI. But the shock of it was so much, and I looked at my attorney, and I went, is that good? You know, it was just, we were just in shock. And, you know, after my attorney goes, yes, Jimmy, that's, you know, that's what you, that was the best you could do. So it was difficult. It was hard. And then after that was, you know, waiting for the sentencing, to where I was still facing 6 months, just for the DUI. And then of course that turned out to just be a first time offense DUI and a fine and community service that I did. And, but it was, was very valuable.
Right. We could say there's nothing great that came from that experience other than to say that we have to suggest that justice was served properly in that situation, and that gives you some faith in our system. But
the thing about it is, just real quick, because you brought that up, you know, our system on a whole is working, but there's a lot of people in our system that use it to take advantage of it.
Exactly.
And this is what that state attorney was doing. She was trying to advance her career by using my name. And, you know, it was one of those things, you know, it was great to have the stardom being a New York Yankee and winning, but that also kind of worked against me because it gave this state attorney an opportunity to garner more publicity for herself. Sure. By keeping my name out there.
And finally, the other thought is that, and not to just pick on the press, but I mean, you know, it's the dark story that they go for. The conclusion to this, I don't know that there's a lot of people that are not, let's say, sports fans or even Yankee fans, know the result of this situation.
No, it's true.
You know, as opposed to, and really the facts of it, as opposed to the initial onslaught of the first week or two, you know?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on my Twitter, on my Facebook, all these different cats. Yeah, you'll look and you'll see something come up about me, and somebody says, "Oh, well, he can't do it; he's in jail."
Right.
Like, you know, what are you talking about? You know, it's a thing that, and that's kind of what the book kind of gave me the opportunity. Those last three chapters in the book gave me the opportunity to really let it all out there of what really went on during those 3 years, and just how the system, you know, the state attorney was working the system against me to a point where, you know. The one thing that happened in I don't know how much time do we have?
We have like 30 seconds here.
Okay. We'll pick it up on the next segment.
Yeah, that's fine. And then, you know, it's everything for a reason in some ways, and certainly it's not always us to decide what the reason is or the trials and tribulations we need to go through. But we'll on the other side, we'll take a look at some of the lessons from this, and also get back to a little bit more discussion about some of the charities and lessons and work that this may have driven you to do, maybe not have otherwise done. But anyway, we'll talk about that in a few minutes on Everything Old is New Again with Jim Leyritz.
Here come the Yankees.
This is Everything Old is New Again, America's entertainment pop culture talk show with Douglas Viviani and David Cohen.
Leyritz the hitter. He's untouchable. Leyritz, high and deep to left field. He has done it again. Wow, what a shot. 2-1 San Diego.
All right, for our West Coast fans, there's a 98 home run from Jim Leyritz replayed here on Everything Old is New Again. And I just wanted to explore the fact that just go back to one home run, the last section, in 96, home run in the World Series. You used Daryl Strawberry's bat to hit that home run game four. And then in 99, the one we just heard, the last home run, I'm sorry, that wasn't the one we just heard, but the one we heard last section, that was the last home run of the 20th century, you did pinch hitting for Strawberry. So there's a kinship there with Daryl Strawberry. Does he realize that, or did you ever talk about that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we talk about it all the time. You know, Daryl, you know, is similar in his faith that I am, and, you know, he's actually out there now as a minister, ministering to people and helping people. And I think, you know, both of us kind of have a kinship even after baseball, because we're both kind of doing the same thing out there, helping to change lives and use what we were given from our baseball careers as far as the name and the status to be able to help other people.
And you all seem to change lives with this. Now, you're on the board of 9/11 Education Trust Foundation. Can you tell us a little bit of what that is?
Well, yeah, the 9/11 board is what we do every year with Cantor Fitzgerald and, of course, the memorial service. What we do is because they won't allow it in the history books yet, when we're still fighting to find that day when they will allow the event to be in the history books to be able to teach all kids really what happened. But what we do is we hire teachers. We hire individuals to go into these schools all around the United States to be able to teach on 9/11, because some of the teachers aren't comfortable doing it. So we send people into other schools and other places to really teach the kids today what 9/11 is about and what this whole memorial services are and everything that we're doing, so people don't forget, so these kids understand that the impact of that was so great that changed the world, not only New York City, but the world.
So
that's one of the boards I'm on. And then the two other companies, I work for two other companies, and I'll just throw them in real quick. One is PinkTie.org. It's a part of a title insurance company that I work for. We do commercial and residential real estate, but we fund a charity called PinkTie. And it's a 100% pass-through charity that we help all different types of charities and foundations that need financial assistance by putting on, you know, events or finding donors and finding, you know, sponsors for them to be able to help them raise money. And it's one of the greatest organizations I've been blessed to be a part of. Mike and Rich Cave, who are my bosses at First Equity, are the ones that created that. And then that's in New York, and then in California where I live. Basically, I'm in California 20 days, New York 10 days every month. And so when in California where I'm at, I work with a company called Sports One Marketing, which is run by Warren Moon, the former quarterback. And it's his foundation that all the money's raised for that we do. And his partner is Dave Meltzer, who is one of my mentors. He's out there speaking with innovator and entrepreneur stuff, but that's how we raise the money to be able to donate some of it back to Warren's foundation. So I've been very blessed to be able to, as they're saying at Sports One, is make a lot of money, help a lot of people, have a lot of fun. And I've been very blessed to be able to have two jobs that I can do that.
That's great. That's great.
It's great stuff. And just as an aside, First Equity Title Company is out of Melville, New York, where I grew up. It's on the map for two reasons, not just First Equity and Pink Tie, but the originator of Everything Old is New Again. Just kidding around. But the idea is that they're tied in with, again, pinktie.org. Go to that on the website. Check that out. You can also, I'm sure, 9/11 Education Trust Foundation has a website as well to help people become aware and donate to these worthwhile charities. And the Sports One Marketing, I presume, I don't have it handy, but if you Google, I'm sure you can find the information there on that as well, right, on the internet?
Yes. Yeah, actually, yeah, Warren's charity is called the Crescent Moon Foundation. When they get scholarships for kids that would normally not have a chance, an opportunity to go to college, and he hands out probably 30, 40 a year to kids through his Crescent Moon Foundation.
That's great. I mean, it's great work, and we want to acknowledge that what you went through, the highs and the lows, which we spoke about, have kind of produced this result. So again, everything for a reason in a way. You're now able to use your celebrity that is continuing for speaking engagements with JimLayritz.com for this book, Catching Heat, and now again for these charities, 9/11 Education Trust Foundation, and then pinktie.org and so forth. Not only those, you have a little bit of indication that you're a little bit associated with the ALS Association for Lou Gehrig's disease as well, right? Your brother-in-law
that was a personal connection where I unfortunately lost my brother-in-law in 2010, my sister's husband, to Lou Gehrig's disease after battling it for 2 years. And so, you know, I was always involved. It was kind of interesting because I was always involved with Lou Gehrig's, obviously being a Yankee, doing all their events throughout the years. And when my brother-in-law got the disease, Chris Pendergrass, who is one of the poster boys in New York, has had it for 25 years. Him and I became good friends over the years. And he actually, not able to speak, but able to dictate letters, sent my sister a letter that really was helpful for her to kind of, you know what they were going to go through and the battles that they were going to go through. And that's why that's also one of the charities that I work for.
Yeah, it certainly is worthwhile. You know, you hear that and you I don't know, the impression is, oh, Lou Gehrig had it. It's very, very rare. No one gets it now. And that's not necessarily true. I think even Catfish Hunter has succumbed to that a little ways back as well. So it is prevalent, and it's something that, again, to all the layperson kind of can do is support these organizations with the best you can with a couple of dollars. So maybe they can try to find at least ways to monitor maybe predict and or deal with these, ALS for sure is a difficult thing to go through. We're finishing up the last few minutes here with Jim. We wanted to finish up a little discussion, if you wanted to, about the lessons learned from your life and what you have in the last pages of the book, if you want to.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the last chapter of the paragraph of the book says, I don't think I've ever learned any deep, lasting, life-changing lessons on the crest of success. But I have learned very little from winning. But I have learned a great deal from losing. I became a hero in 1996, only to find myself clamoring out of subsequent hardships, which is, of course, the accident and the custody battles and everything else. Such is the game of life. There's a hero inside of each of us, and the journey towards peace of mind and acceptance for both the good and the bad that happen in life is a journey that I now offer you as you round the basis of your life and try to find your best way home safe. And that's kind of, you know, the way that I've, you know, one thing that I, when I left the courtroom that day, I made a promise to the judge and to God that I was going to continue to change lives, continue to go out there and speak to kids about drinking and driving, the dangers of it, and that, you know, the woman's death would not be in vain, and that everything that I would do. And one of the things that I was kind of surprised when I moved to California was I thought for sure that baseball would come back, and I was found innocent. You know, I thought for sure, okay, people would see that. And none of that came back. And the TV radio stuff didn't come back. And so I was frustrated a little bit, but then I realized that all these other blessings that were coming upon me, these other job offers that were happening, they were happening slowly, but they were happening. And it all had to do with charities and foundations and give backs. And it was a way for me to be able to take care of my family financially, but also to be able to continue to go out and help individuals, which was the promise I made when I walked out of that courtroom.
And Jim, do you still have a desire to get back into baseball at some point if the opportunity presents itself?
You know, there's a lot of people that called me this year when Girardi got fired and said, hey, you know, you're going to put your name in the hat, everybody else is, you know, but, you know, I still have my 16-year-old and two stepdaughters that are 12 and 15 that I'm raising out here in California. And if I went back to coaching, I'd be gone 8 months out of the year.
Hmm, yeah.
And it would probably be a little bit of a pay cut from what I'm making now with the title company. And I really wouldn't. I don't think I would change it. I think maybe, you know, somewhere down the line, TV and radio may come back in. Because I really did excel in that and enjoy that. And that's something that, again, you know, you're not gone the entire 8 months. So I think that's still a possibility. But I really, honestly, I don't see in the next couple of years it changing, because I really, really love what I'm doing now.
That's great to hear. And let's just have, in a couple of minutes here, just a kind of a fun discussion. I always had this in my mind as far as the player's point of view of what we call the roll call at Yankee Stadium. The started with the bleacher creatures, the fans in the bleachers would yell out a person before the, in the first inning of the game, as the game is starting, yell out the player's name, all of them, one at a time, and the players would raise the hand or acknowledge that, and then they move on to the next player. I'm sure you're familiar with that and experienced that more than a few times. What would be the player's impression of that? I never heard anyone ever talk about that. Did you like it? Did you feel it was an obligation, an interference? What do you think?
You know what? It's the passion of the New York Yankee fans. I go out there and do the roll call with these guys. A lot of the bleacher creature guys are our fantasy camp guys that come down to fantasy camp every year for the Yankees.
Huh.
So they always invite us to come out and sit with them, and you know, we'll go out there. I probably went into about 10 or 12 games this year and sat out there with them. For me, it's great to be on the other side,
right,
screaming to these guys. But as a player, it really is. It's just such a connection with the fans that's why it's to this day. I have never seen one player not acknowledge when we do the roll call.
Well, they won't stop chanting your name until you do, right? So you have no choice.
I wouldn't be surprised if we were back in the day of Reggie Jackson. He would purposely wait 5 minutes just to hear his name for 5 minutes over and over again.
You're probably right.
But it is a lot of fun. They should do that everywhere. To hear from you that the players kind of enjoy that, it's nice to hear that there's a two-way street there.
Yeah, no, it is. And like I said, that's the one thing about, you know, Derek Jeter's retirement speech. There are no greater fans than the fans of New York. And when you win in New York, they never forget you. You know, and it was such an honor to be able to play there. I miss Mr. Steinbrenner more than I miss anybody, because he ran that organization first class, and he was always loyal to the former players. You know, he was such a passionate. We talked about it all this whole segment about the passion for something. He had such a passion for being an owner of the Yankees, but also trying to put a winning product on the field, that it was such a great opportunity to play for.
And we have a passion for making radio fun again. Hopefully we've done that with a great time for an hour here with the great Jim Leyritz from the New York Yankees, San Diego Padres. You did and do affect the nation in whole, and with your charity work and your inspiring story with that you can catch up and listen and watch from Catching Heat and Speaking Engagements. Everybody wants to have Jim come on by, jimleyritz.com. Mr. Leyritz, thank you ever so much for spending some time. Two Yankee fans are shaking hands now with you and patting you on the back for a job well done. Thank you so much.
Well, guys, I appreciate you having me today. Thank you, Doug. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Jim.
Here come the Yankees.
Okay, Jim, we're all set here.
No problem.
You handled that very well. I appreciate you doing that. Thank you.
No problem.
I think it goes a long way too for people to, like Dave, I mean, is acknowledging that. I don't think from walking in today you really knew the whole story.
I didn't. You know? In fact, you know, and a lot of my friends are Yankee fans, and Jim, I told them that you were going to be on the show, and they're like, "Wow, that's so cool." Yeah, whatever happened with that trial? Yeah. You know, like no one really knows what the end result was.
Well, here's the funny thing too. My book is finally starting to take off. People are starting to realize that I wrote a book. The PR company that was hired when we wrote the book was didn't know anything about sports. And I argued with the company, like, listen, why don't you hire somebody that, you know, knows something about sports? And they didn't. Huh. And I think also, too, I think, just like you're saying, the knowledge of what was going on, a lot of people didn't know. It's been 6 years almost, and people now have seen me out. They've seen what I've been doing, and they're like, oh, you got a book out. You know, let's read it. And I always tell people that buy the book, I go, you know, if you don't read the whole book, at least read the last page.
Right.
Because the last page pretty much sums up the reason that I wrote, you know, the reason for the book, but also, you know, the inspiration that I want to try to bring to people.
Right.
That look at me and go, oh, you know, you had such a great life, and you did that, you know. And then also, the other thing that I liked about it, too, was it gave me the opportunity, because the media made it sound like I was having such a difficult time transitioning from my career into what I was doing. And at the time of the accident, I was one of the leading reporters for ESPN and Fox. I did the 2007. Unfortunately, I had to cover the Red Sox in 2007 for the World Series.
Oh, you're the reason. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, and I was making $400,000 a year, and I had a pretty good life. I mean, it was, you know, but you would have never guessed that. And I love it when people always say to me, you know, oh my God, you know, you got through, you know, how did you get through? You know, you were so messed up. And I'm like, no, it was an accident.
Right.
You know, it was something that unfortunately I wasn't in control of. And it completely, you know, derailed it. And, the way things were portrayed. And that's why I said I was so blessed to be able to write the book, because the book does kind of set things straight a little.
Yeah, because that's the killer. We'll get back on the show in a minute, but that's the killer. Is you see the photos, you know, that they produce when the event occurred, and it's you celebrating, you know, the Yankees' victories and so forth, as if you're doing that every day.
They use the same picture from the '96 World Series.
Right.
It says I was out celebrating my birthday.
Right, exactly. Like you're doing that, like living that life every single day too. You know what I mean? But
exactly.
It's a killer. I'm glad you have the opportunity to you know, face this and correct and at least let people know the truth. You know what I mean?
We should do this when we go back on. I think that's an important point to make, right?
Which one?
Talked about.
Yes. Okay, and then we'll start right up. And what we, if you like, what we could do is we could take that section and put it on our podcast as well, if it doesn't go on the air and people hear this as well with that. So, but let's see what we can do. We'll start it right now.